Good morning, everybody, for the final morning session of this ASEF meeting. And Andrew is going to lead us through a note that he wrote about intangible assets.
Thank you, Hans.
Go ahead, Andrew.
Thanks. Yes, I'm sure you've had copies of and seen the paper that we published. It was published in February with comments requested by the end of June, so the comment period is now formally over. You've also received a summary of the paper, as well as, and that paper also includes an overview of what we learned from the responses. And you've got some slides, which are a summary of the paper. So what I'm just going to do is to tee up the session by quickly going through the slides, so it's a sort of summary of a summary of a summary, if you like. And the only other introductory comment I would make is that intangibles are quite hard to get to grips with. So why did we do it? Well, we did it, I think, mainly because there is criticism of intangibles and particularly the financial reporting response there too. It's not new, and that's a point we tried to underline in the paper, that people have been saying this for a considerable period of time, but sometimes it grows in intensity, and we just felt that it was kind of a good idea just to say, well, can we respond to that in a thoughtful way? You know, can we actually, rather than just sort of pretend to have deaf ears to it all, can we sort of try and see what could in fact be done to improve the business communication of intangibles? And by say business communication, that leads me to a couple of points. One is that we restricted it to business reporting, so it doesn't address the not-for-profit sector, for example. It also focuses on communication with investors, but we were quite careful to say that that was not because we didn't think ESG reporting or reporting to other stakeholders was important. It's just that we wanted to try to maintain a tight focus on the paper. We also said, well, you know, some of this stuff kind of sounds like people are calling for a whole new sort of paradigm of financial reporting. Although actually, if you've got the patience to get to the end of many of these publications, you find that their proposals are relatively modest.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, we didn't want to spend any time trying to say, well, we want a new paradigm of accounting, because that would take us 30 years. But we really wanted to focus on what could be done now. We also didn't really focus in the paper on who should do what, but rather what the solutions might be, and left it very open as to what role preparers, auditors, investors, and standard setters should play in that process. And it follows that we didn't get into to any extent at all, really, what extent the information might be subject to audit or subject to assurance. The other thing that we wanted to do, and this was challenging because the literature on the economics of intangibles is vast, but we tried to relate it not just to our own perceptions of what intangibles might be, but to what some of the economic literature identifies as, you know, features of intangibles, and see what we could learn from that. I guess the other sort of comment I might make is that we were trying to... Sorry, I've forgotten what the other point I was about to make was, so I'll just pass on. We looked at the current framework, and we said, well, the first thing to look at is, do intangibles meet the definition of an asset? And that reminds me of the point that I forgot a moment ago, which is that intangibles, we note, are an incredibly diverse set of things, if indeed you can almost call them a set, because it's just a sort of catch-all phrase for everything. And therefore, many of the observations apply at a high level of generality. So if you think about the definition of an asset, I mean, there are clearly some And if you buy a patent, then I don't think many of us would have any doubt that you've acquired an asset. But for a great many intangibles, all the things that people are concerned about when they talk about intangibles, things like customer loyalty, a well-trained workforce, then it would seem very doubtful whether they meet that definition. And therefore, given where accounting is today, and probably where it will be for the rest of my lifetime, we can't put them on the balance sheet. We then looked at recognition and say, well, look at cost, look at fair value. And this is really where we drew on the economic literature to some extent, in that, you know, we think that the cost of an intangible is quite different at a high level of generality from the cost of a tangible asset, because typically with a tangible asset, you know what it's going to cost and you know what it's going to bring to you in terms of economic benefits. If you say to somebody, you know, go and build a better mousetrap, you've no idea how long it will take or how successful that product will be. And so we talked a bit about things like scalability, network effects, and so on. And so perhaps controversially, and we'll come to what people said about it, we were rather doubtful whether in many, many cases intangibles can be meaningfully quantified either at cost or at value. Does that mean that financial reporting is done and that we have to immediately go to some kind of narrative reporting or something? The answer is no, because we noted that very often companies invest in intangibles and write them off only because they don't meet the definition or the recognition criteria for inclusion as an asset. And we thought, well, and don't claim to have invented this idea here, but wouldn't it be a good idea, to the extent that you think you've invested in the period in intangibles that will benefit the future, you should disclose them as a separate line item. And that would give a clearer view of what are the actual results that, the income less expenses that were incurred in this year and were consumed in this year, as opposed to those that are written off purely as a because of the constraints of accounting. And so slide 6 gives a kind of illustration of how that income statement might look. We didn't actually include that illustration in the paper that we published, but perhaps it would have been better if we had. Draw your attention to the line in red, staff training for the future. And we said, well, not only can you disclose it as a separate line item, but why don't we have disclosure of the cumulative amount of what we're calling future-oriented intangibles, to the extent that you think they're still going to benefit the future. But we did include in the paper the illustration on slide 7, and you can see that that ties up to the income statement. by the way, I think some people prefer the term revenue investment to future-oriented intangibles, and perhaps that's a better term for it. Then we looked at narrative reporting. First observation was that you can't expect everybody to report on every intangible, because compiling an inventory of it would be an exhausting and exhaustive task. But you can say, well, what are the ones that are really important to the creation of value by the business? We then talked quite a bit about how metrics might supplement a narrative discussion of your progress of intangibles, and we highlighted some qualities that we thought would make them particularly useful. First of all, they ought to be clearly defined, and I think we said that it would be quite handy if companies in similar businesses or similar industries used similar definitions. They should be disaggregated, because staff turnover, if your workforce is one of your key intangibles, then staff turnover might be something you would choose to disclose. But you've got to disaggregate it because, or you may have to disaggregate it because turnover of delivery drivers may be rather of a different significance from that of product designers. We suggested it would be useful to publish trends, and something like 3 years so people can see how things are going, and also targets. So that, you know, I mean, if staff turnover is 5%, it's kind of hard to know whether that's good, bad, or indifferent, unless you say what is, you know, what you regard as being an achievable and acceptable target. And slide 9 shows, you know, an illustration of how we thought that kind of thing might look like. So turning to what respondents actually said, we were quite satisfied with the number of responses that we got. There was a great deal of, well, most people seemed to think it was worth looking at the subject and supported the initiative. A few of them mainly confined their comments to research and development as if that was the only kind of intangibles. One thing I didn't mention before was that we talked about the criteria for capitalisation that are in IAS 38 and suggested how they might be tweaked. That didn't gain a huge amount of support. I think it's fair to say that views were divided, mainly because people thought that IAS 38 worked well. And I may be putting words into their mouth, but the sense I got was that another reason why there wasn't a great deal of support for that was that it didn't really go to the heart of the issue, and in any event, you'd end up capitalising relatively few intangibles. So that was one that where views were not hugely supportive. On the valuation point, most people agreed that the valuation of intangibles is extremely difficult. A few thought that the problems are insurmountable. And that valuation would be a useful thing to do. I think reflecting the view that if you just try hard enough, you can come up with a value, and perhaps if we can achieve consensus that that is the value, then that is the value. As I say, the majority agreed that providing a value is both subject not only to some difficulty, but also to conceptual challenge, and in any cases of doubtful value. Future-oriented intangibles, again, views were divided as to what we said about that, but it was quite interesting that that gave to some fairly strongly expressed views, both for and against. Those who were against mainly focused on subjectivity as to the decision as to, you know, does this advertising campaign benefit this year or does it benefit next year? As I said at the outset, the paper was short, so it didn't go into a huge degree of detail on that, but it did say that if you're taking that forward, you'd have to consider things like disclosing what your policy is for making that decision and what you do think benefits the future and why. And on the narrative reporting, the discussion about metrics and so on, I think we got a fair degree of support. Although, obviously, people raised concerns about the cost of doing this, and the commercially sensitive argument also featured. So on slide 15, which I hope is the same as the last paragraph of the covering paper, I set out some questions that I think it would be useful for ASAF to discuss. And I look forward to your observations.
Alex.
Well, it's been immensely well received paper in terms of paying attention to, I think, to the right question. So it's a very important subject, which I like your analogy of playing death. One of the most you see financial statements of some companies are just book value of equity and cash, and that's all, and because everything else is out of the financials. So It's many participants agree that the my jurisdiction plays that this is something that we should devote much more time than we are devoting now. One thing that came up was that trying to be realistic here is that we're trying to solve two problems at the same time. The first problem is of recognition. The other problem is of measurement. And there are maybe you should split this discussion in two. And first of all, focus on the intangibles that are currently not recognized, and that we do not have any doubt that they are assets by the current definition, being brand, the most obvious example. So a brand is very well defined, very well identifiable. You can sell it, can buy it, you can legally protect it. So no doubt from the current definition of asset that a brand is an asset. So, and I only recognize it when I buy it on a business combination. So I don't recognize it when I internally generate. So this, I think that we can see other internally generated intangibles which meet well the definition of asset. And so you don't have to face this discussion first. So it's just going to be only a measurement of and that approach that you use for training the workforce may be applied to brand too. So this amount that I'm expensing to maintain the current value of the brand, and this amount of expensing for the future. So this was the maybe it's a too complex answer to be solved at once. So maybe we should try to split it in pieces and try to solve the one. And then strong support for the narratives, especially on KPIs being provided. But it should be interesting if those KPIs provided are related to actually the intangibles that we are actually accounting for. So otherwise we can become disconnected. So it seems to be an obvious recommendation, but I think that's important. So this was the main recommendation that we got, so which is maybe split it into parts and focus on which is more.
Thank you.
Nick?
Thank you, and thank you again for the report and the presentation. I'm a big fan of the report as well. And as you say, one of the issues is there's a huge spectrum of resources here. From, I guess, at one end, I'd see computer software, probably the most tangible of the intangibles. And at the other end of the spectrum, almost the glue that holds an entity together, that is the raison d'etre to its business model, all of which are important. And I guess that leads us to this being a cross-cutting issue, and certainly it touches a number of areas of our work. What we hear from investors, I'd say, are three important areas of concern. One is around the disclosure of future-orientated expense, as you describe it, and that's not always captured. The second one is the inconsistency between acquired and internally generated intangible assets. Although there the take would be different, there's a great scepticism to the reliability of the value placed on brands and customer relationships. And I can say I've never, ever seen those numbers quoted in a broker's report over my entire career. So I think people are more dubious about putting more on in that respect. And the third area is around narrative reporting. I think the work on here in your report on the narrative is particularly helpful as we think about the management commentary, how we tackle that within there, and we should be taking that away. But I have a couple of questions. One is there's been academic research that shows that companies have been reluctant to capitalize and to their development expenditure. They'd rather not, when they could, they'd rather not put that onto their balance sheet because of fear of future impairment. Do we just end up with the same situation with, even though it's just a disclosure, but around future-orientated expenditure, people really don't want to have that cumulative total because they fear that they're going to have to effectively write that down, even though it's not a balance sheet amount in the future. And the second question, which Chiara may be talking about in a moment, is just an update. I'm intrigued where EFRAG are, because I think you also have a project on intangibles as well. Thank you.
Thank you. We received comments from four AO SSG members. They are Australia, Japan, Korea, and Pakistan. And generally, all of the four members appreciate the initiative by the FRC based on the growing importance of intangibles. For question one, one member mentioned the high risk that companies might provide misleading information because the reporting would be highly judgmental. That member encourages the FRC to do research before deciding which areas should be prioritized. The research would be on how to encourage the best practice reporting under the existing requirements. Another member said further outreach is needed to see specifically which intangibles should be recognized. That member supports the requirements under the current IA 38. That member believes integrated reporting or other management reporting should be considered for reporting of intangibles. On the other hand, one member suggests long-term, the framework and the standards should be reconsidered based on the importance of intangibles. That member believes intangibles information should be shown on the face of the financial statement, including those which are not recognized under the current standards.
This is Australia. You know the previous one was Japan, right?
That's the comments from the AOSS members. Question two, one member noticed the suggested reporting could be subject to manipulation. For example, profit before future-oriented items would be subject to manipulation because judgment is required to decide which item is future-oriented and which item is not. Also, judgment is needed to measure such items. Another member is also concerned about how to identify future-oriented items. Even when such items are identified, it would be difficult to estimate how future-oriented items will contribute to future cash flows. If intangible information is to be disclosed, that member believes it should be done outside the financial statements. And for question three, one member believes that depends on the framework where narrative disclosure is presented, and the information is highly judgmental and difficult to audit. One member believes there might be unintended consequences if information is disclosed within financial statements because the information is subjective and distinctive. That member mentioned that companies could consider other reporting documents to provide information on intangibles. For question four, two members believe standard setters could do outreach and consultation. One member said it's important to do outreach with investors, focusing on industries where innovation is already monitored. That member mentioned industry associations should be consulted to engage preparers. That's a summary of the comments from AOSS's members on this topic.
Thank you. Yara.
Yes, and indeed, from the consultation in 2018, we have added the project on this topic. The main items that attracted attention during the consultation were internally generated intangibles, a possible recognition in the face of the balance sheet, as Alexandro was also saying, and the disclosure of value drivers. In terms of project plan, we are currently working on the academic literature, and we plan to issue in the third quarter a first paper with the outcome of this phase, followed very probably by a paper of problem definition before going to explore the solutions. When we discussed the FRC papers, the paper was very well received with a lot of comments, because we believe it's very important to approach the subject. But more than jumping to the solutions in terms of separate reporting of the future-oriented intangibles or the narrative reporting, we found that it's important, first of all, to understand how the information on intangible is consumed by the users before going to the test of the solutions. There were also few members that considered that IAS 38 on intangibles should be reviewed, at least in terms of targeted revision of this standard. One suggestion was to have a joint outreach or approach where users, preparers, standard setters, and others are sitting together and working on this topic. And then going more deeply into the technical details of the project and of the different development that are going on at the same time, it seems to be a lot of development by different organizations on non-financial information, narrative information. And sometimes there is a risk to create confusion from the overlapping developments. So one thing that was really, really important was to clearly identify the boundaries of the different initiatives. And I think the discussion that we had yesterday on your project on the management commentary can be of great help in helping identify clearly the boundaries of the various projects to be more constructive and progress also with this topic.
Thank you. We agree that the business reporting of intangibles requires improvement, and we commend Andrew and the FRC for putting the paper together. However, our current thinking is that it is best to provide more information in outside of the financial statements, for example, in the management commentary, and for three main reasons. The first is that we believe information would be more useful if the information were combined with management's views that may be forward-looking, which better is belong to the management commentary. The second is that if we put information in the managed commentary, we don't need to think whether this potential item meets the definition of an asset or not. If it's, if it provides useful information, you could put it in financial statements, in the financial report. And thirdly, we believe that it allows more flexibility in how to present the information if it's put into a management commentary rather than in the financial statements, so given the context and that there are potentially various types of intangibles that could be reported. In terms of the paper, we have two small comments. One is that we had a little bit of difficulty understanding how or the scope of the future-oriented intangibles were. The definition was not necessarily clear to us. And secondly, we support the view that narrative reporting is not limited to qualitative information, but it helps to include metrics or quantitative information within the explanation. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah,
first of all, we are very impressed by the researches FRC continues to conduct on intangibles. And we welcome the suggestion of what we call realistic proposals. At the same time, we are very inspired by responses from FRC's researches with U.S. stakeholders. And a couple of comments I have to focus on is business intangibles become much more important than financial information, financial instruments, and investment properties. And secondly, what Summer said is the measurement uncertainty is no longer a barrier for improvement of reporting of intangibles, considering fair market value is used for tangibles such as real properties and financial instruments, even when viable market doesn't exist. Also, value in use could be or should be the measurement basis for intangibles. In fact, Korea, KSB, continue to work on a few research projects on intangible assets. The most recent project focused on developing what we call a statement, which will show the value of business intangibles, what we call core business intangibles of a business entity. The statement is similar to the balance sheet in the form, but it is different in the nature because it reports only intangible assets of the business entity rather than tangible assets. The statement will report the monetary value of the intangibles, not the cost. At the same time, the statement will be reporting only core intangibles. That means as opposed to the old intangibles. So we try to focus on only core intangibles. The core intangibles or core business intangibles will vary by industry. It will be different industry by industry. And core business intangibles, the statement could be prepared by the management, but it will be used independently from financial report for the time being. We have to think about whether this will be part of the financial statement or not in the future. That's something everybody has to work on. And actually, we try to complete this attempt by the end of this year. And we will continue to work on whether this statement will be really useful. And we'll have to test whether this is really practicable. But what we are currently doing is that we try to bring in PwC so that they can prepare a test statement of this core intangible. So we have to, we'll be able to watch whether someone can prepare a statement of intangibles. So this is what we are currently doing. And if it is completed, probably we'll be able to show you and listen to your comments. Thank you.
Outrageous. I was just thinking if management is expected to do this, which company could conceivably produce an estimation of its intangibles which is lower than its market value?
And in fact,
is that conceivable?
And in fact, we are working with PwC, and they actually are working on one industry, which is the game industry.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, game industry is a very symbolic industry, which has a very limited amount of properties and assets, while the market capitalization is really huge.
Yeah.
The difference will be the intangibles, and we thought the core intangible of game industry is a game.
Yeah.
So we tried to enumerate a couple of different games, like ten games, and we tried to put the market value of those individual games. So I think we could do the same exercise with different industries, like pharmaceutical industry. Definitely, products, drugs will be the intangible asset, which is obviously not the tangible asset. So I think this is an attempt, so I don't know whether this will be successful, but this is a...
But you use the market as a reference to value the items, of course, so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
That's what I think. But, when a company might actually, like a gaming company, they might have a feeling about a certain game that it is at the end of its life and will probably be wiped out in... But that might not be at all reflected. The market might not know that. It's not reflected in the market value of the company, in the market capitalization. How can possibly this company come up with an estimation of intangibles which would be lower than the market value? Then it basically tells the market, you've got it all wrong. You please lower our share price. And that's never going to happen.
That market value might not relate to identifiable intangibles either, right?
Well, there are a couple of points we are discussing with the PwC and scholars. And what I understand is that even though there will be a total amount of intangibles, like a total amount of gains of one single company, the total will not really explain 100% of market capitalization, but it could be a symbolic numbers. It's a management declaration. I believe this is the value of the intangibles, which will be realized through cash flow in the future. And it could fluctuate year by year.
Yeah, of course.
And in terms of credibility, I would say in the first year, there won't be that much of credibility, but if they do it year by year, like if they do it 10 years, they should be much more prudent and they should be much more faithful. So level of trust will not be same with the current finance statement, but we will be able to look at the company and we'll be able to put some credit to different statement of intangibles.
Hans, I think the other way around also works, because the market value of a company, say that the market value of a company has to equal the value of its intangibles. It takes a very, very broad definition of intangible. Let me give you an example. It's a competitive position. The company is in a duopoly. Yeah. Is this intangible for the company?
Yeah.
It's really
long as you're able to maintain the duopoly.
But it's intangible. It's a competitive position. So if you're equaling those two things, you're taking a very, very broad definition.
Market shares are important.
I don't think it has to be the case.
But I think the reality is, for all these reasons, there's hardly any investor that looks at the balance sheet for valuations.
Right.
And rightly so, except for looking at risks in the leverage and stuff like that. But they look at all these, they make estimations of, they look at the current cash flows and they make estimations of future cash flows based on the income statement. And
obviously, I've read the book.
No, you're right, huh?
Very clever.
You're right. But the point is not the balance sheet, the point is the definition of experts. Because depending on how you define on the balance sheet, that defines your definition of expense for the recurring net income. So.
But I think the balance sheet is not familiar. And that's what Nick said, that most investors, they don't look at the balance sheet because...
Doesn't seem like a problem. So they don't use the balance sheet.
Thank you.
Yes, they do.
So kudos to the work, Andrew. We think it's hugely important, and it lends itself to some... I'm not going to repeat what others have said. Like, I agree that you could take Alexandro's approach and say what would lend itself to what we currently do from a standard-setting perspective, and therefore I like the notion of metrics, and that lends itself to narrative reporting. I agree with some of the things Chiara said. I think, though, if you step back, first of all, it kind of brings to play what the role of the standard setter could be in this topic. Because if you think that the only solution that the standard setter has is setting standards to put things in the financial statements that will subsequently get audited, are you limiting yourself to the role of the influence and the leadership you could have in addressing these types of issues? Because it may not lend itself to that process, and if you try to use the same process continually, it's going to take you too many years to do it, and we're not going to see any improvement in financial reporting. I think what we're talking about here is improving the quality of information that people can get, whether it's through the financial statements, the narrative reporting, or whatever. And so that's why our board chose to do our framework on performance measures, because basically what we said to people was, we don't really care where you're putting this information, but if you know that users are using it, it should have a certain quality to it. And we decided to use our leadership role as a standard setter to raise awareness to an issue, even though we weren't going to set a standard to do it. And I think that's something we should all be thinking about, because the fact of the matter is, I think Nick said it best, users are getting information, and they're getting it from wherever they're getting it. And so what do we decide to do about that? And so I think we can kind of narrow this down into different areas where we can make some statements
and get people to provide better information. I don't think we should gate ourselves in terms of whether something can be audited or not audited. So, you know, we talked, it came up a couple times yesterday that the financial statements are basically backwards looking. And I take certain exception to that as a former preparer, because embedded in the financial statements are many things where you have to take a view on forward-looking information.
Sure.
Many.
Yeah.
And somehow, magically, that's getting audited today. Okay. So I'm simply saying that if you think about all the ways you come up with different discount rates, you disclose risks in terms of IFRS 7. I mean, you do impairment testing. There are many times that you make a judgment as a preparer, and then the auditor audits that judgment. So in my view, if we expect preparers to come up with information, then we look to our auditing colleagues to be able to audit that information. And so I don't think that should be a gating factor to the work that the standard setter should do. I think it's something to be dealt with. So bottom line, I think this is a discussion we should be continuing to having, because it's not a new issue. So back in the days when I was dealing with impairment testing, one of my fun things to do was, at the end of the whole technical process, I had to look at the difference between the value we came up with versus the market value of the company. And that was always fun, because they were hugely divergent. Now, intuitively, I could say, well, it makes sense to me because of this brand, you know, the assembled workforce, whatever. I couldn't put values on them, but I could assess them and say, there you go, and I gave an airy-fairy memo to the auditors, and we moved on till the next year. So I think this is not a new issue. It's just becoming more and more pressing. And so the question becomes, what do we as standard setters do? And one of the things we can do is raise awareness to the issue and tell people to get on with things and not stay in their little silos. So that may involve, you know, talking to securities regulators to say, is this better placed in a management commentary document? That brings into play the importance of your management commentary project, so that we can all say, yeah, this is the kind of things that should be in management commentary. We can go back to our individual jurisdictions where we have, you know, local regulatory guidance and say, shouldn't we be thinking about making these improvements here in our current jurisdiction? So simply put, I think this is a hugely important area. But I think we as standard setters collectively shouldn't necessarily go back to the one toolkit we have, which is setting a standard so that we can put something on the balance sheet, but rather how do we influence the getting better quality information out there, however we do that.
Raymond.
I agree wholeheartedly with what I had to say. I think when we've had a lot of corporate failures in the last little while, and a lot of that has been because of companies that have got significant intangibles on their balance sheet, which, when you look at the disclosures that they've got, you know, does not really explain what it is that they've got on their balance sheet in any way, shape, or form. And, you know, I guess the corporate failures have been highlighted, you know, have highlighted these intangibles a lot more than, you know, we otherwise would have looked at. And I guess my concern at the moment is, where should this information sit? If we put in a tool that says, well, provide more disclosures, or there's more clarity in what an intangible is, that's not necessarily fixing the issue. I think what we need is for people to be able to understand what is sitting on a company's balance sheet and how it arose and how it will ultimately result in any value being created by the organization. And for a lot of companies at the moment, certainly in our part of the world, that information simply does not exist. And people have to try and figure their way around, well, what are these numbers that are sitting on their balance sheet? And a lot of it then results in people speculating about what that information actually means. I think that in itself is potentially problematic. So if we are going to stick something onto the balance sheet, then I think I agree with that we need to make sure that we've got some clarity in the definition of what these intangible assets are, or what makes up these intangible assets. And secondly, if we're going to go the route of, like Linda's suggesting, that you know, we're providing more information in the narrative, then I think we need to make this part and parcel of the coherence project that we discussed at length yesterday. That for me, I think, would result in a lot more detail, a lot more information being provided, which will hopefully enable people to understand what we're talking about.
Jim?
So the first question was the relatively easy one, which is, is there room for improvement? And certainly there is. I agree with many of Kira's comments about starting maybe with users and what is it
the objective that users are looking for, and then tie that to various proposals. And I think outlining those then to what the objective of either the narrative or the disclosure would be might help advance, at least in my mind, some of the ideas. For example, it wasn't so clear to me what the objective of the future-oriented intangibles was. Is that to place a value on the intangibles itself, or is that to assist with projecting future cash flows of the entity? Was that to project future cash inflows, or is that because this would help you model cash outflows? It wasn't clear to me how, for example, knowing the amount spent on training would help you then associate a cash inflow value from having had that training, although it might help you project future training expense. And so if the objective is to project future training expense, that might not be really anything to do with intangibles per se, just future costs. And that got me to, even in those categories, you know, what would be sort of future-oriented. And so I think taking that back to what is the objective might be helpful in then shaping any individual proposal.
Andrew, wasn't the, if I may interrupt, the idea to show that a company can show how much it invests in its people and give an indication, oh, these must be highly trained, they must have.
So I'm not sure that disclosure, well, one, it's not limited to, it seemed like advertising would fit in that, R&D would fit in that, and so it wasn't clear to me. I could be a really inefficient trainer of people,
yeah,
and have a really big number, and that could have very little value.
It's probably better than having nothing to compare two companies, one with another, which is where we are.
Yeah, but that's why I say take it back to what is the objective of the disclosure. Is it just more information for the purpose of information, or how will this help people model future cash flows?
You might want to know what they're being trained in. Mm. Like, is it compliance? So it reduces risk? Is it in future business?
Conversations, certainly.
Yeah. But you might want to know how they're trained. Take the firm I used to work at, invests hundreds of millions in owning its own hotel, its own property, has cleaning people. That would all presumably go into this number. The depreciation on that building, the cleaning of those rooms, certainly if you had external training, you would be paying for that. And so I think maybe not just what is the number, but what's in the number, why are we providing it? And again, is it to model expenses, or is it to model value? I think all of that would just help move proposals forward.
Sure. I think one of the things it achieves is that people see whether you're maintaining your expenditure for the future. I mean, obviously, if you want, to the extent you're to be sort of provocative and perhaps simplistic, if you're playing the earnings game, one way you can meet your forecast is by slashing your advertising expenditure.
Sure. But that might not have anything to do with future-oriented intangibles. I might conclude that my training is just benefits the annual period, and investors would be equally interested in knowing those expenditures. So I think tying that to a disclosure objective will certainly help people understand what it is we would be trying to advance.
But wouldn't our management commentary give us exactly that outcome?
If it's done well, it should be already doing it.
Patrick?
Excuse me, just on training, I was, when you were explaining your reservations, Jim, I was asking myself, also, when I hire a high caliber guy that has been trained by others, I will pay, in fact, training expenses via salary. Because, you know, we should have an average, you know, a basic level of recruitment. You have either internal promotion via training, or you go on the market and buy people that are more expensive. So it's a very difficult HR question, but and it's not easy to have one simple answer to that one. So going back to Andrew's paper, thank you, Andrew, for a very good and very stimulating paper. The question is well defined. The answers are always more difficult than defining the question. The question is how to reflect intangibles, which are, in fact, fast-growing and also perceived as fragile, because we tend to think that, you know, a plant or a machine is something that you can control, when intangible is difficult to to apprehend and comprehend. So, and we are moving to an intangible economy. So by definition, the gap between book values and value is probably growing. And by the way, I think we mentioned this, I mentioned this point yesterday, market values only reflect minority transactions. When you take a majority transaction, you get an additional, I don't know, 10 or 20 or 30%, depending on what you are talking about. So two major comments. The first one, and I follow up on what has been said, but maybe I go a little further to a certain extent. I think it is very difficult to change the paradigm of the, on which financial statements are based. Not only is it difficult from a conceptual standpoint, but I'm wondering if it's not a bit dangerous, because we have a robust platform which is understood. Of course, there are limitations. 10 years ago, we were tempted, some people were tempted by the full fair value model. Okay, gladly, this is not on the table. But, you know, any attempt to try to give more meaning to the financial statements vis-à-vis value is a bit like, you know, trying to play God. So it's, I think it's, and I prefer to have a very stable, robust platform that people understand, even if they don't have a look at the balance sheet at the end of the day. But nevertheless, it's a starting point. So so I don't think we are able to move out of the paradox between acquired intangible and internally generated intangible. It's a fact of life. So. Okay, there is a risk also, if we were to introduce into accounting, to over-concentrate on monetary items, I think. And this is pretty dangerous. We would also tend to immediately be criticized, because we would put more emphasis on the positive sides, and we wouldn't recognize the negatives, the negative externalities that we mentioned yesterday. Because today we are, you know, it's amazing. Yesterday we were talking about non-financial information on risks. Today we are talking about opportunities to a certain extent. So that's destabilization is dangerous. As an example, my board received a request about capitalizing training costs. You know. It was coming from the French Parliament, because people saying, hey, you know, you're investing in human resources, it's, why don't you do something? We analyzed, we said, we can't do much. They didn't like it that much. And we said, maybe a disclosure. So we made a proposal, we put on the table a proposal to the board, and the board rejected the proposal, even on the disclosure in the financial statement, and said, this is for management commentary. It's a good idea, but not in the financial statements. And that was last week. So you were, boom, right on spot. So where to move? And that's maybe where I'm less hesitant. I'm not hesitating. I think that corporate information has to have two legs, quite frankly, the financial one and the non-financial one. And that the answer is not to put more muscle to one leg, because to run we need, or to walk we need two legs, and of equal, you know, if we are unbalanced, it's the problem. So I think that the key, and therefore the interest of the management commentary project, I think that we need to put more flesh and bone on the non-financial side of the information in connection with the financial information. And that's where your paper is particularly important and interesting, the narrative side. It's a key merit of the paper, because I think it is the starting point of a move towards a second leg of significance. The problem for the second leg at the moment is that
We need to recognize the three natures of non-financial information that I mentioned yesterday, because if we do not recognize that, we will reduce the meaning of the information that we give, and also the capacity to interpret this information. I think we need also to, when I say we, I don't know if it's the ISB or accounting standard setters, but there is a need to set standards for the content of information, because if we don't do that,
it's impossible to compare.
And I think that the ultimate rule of the game is to be able to compare and make a decision. And we need to have a taxonomy from day one. So I think that the reporting, the non-financial reporting, should be as comprehensive as possible, identifying the areas and maybe identifying where areas have standards and where areas have no standards so far, because there will be a progress over time. So you need to build the second leg quickly, but also bearing in mind that it will take time to reach the same level of maturity as for financial information. So good stimulation, Andrew. Thank you.
Anne?
Most of our discussion has been about the expenses and over on the income statement and projecting cash flows. Not a lot on the asset side, but I just think that there's the ratios that people use, and those ratios have balance sheet numbers in there. So I know in the beginning of Andrew's presentation, he gave us some feedback on what people were saying about IAS 38, a couple of points there. And then we've picked up also on the feedback from investors who don't want to see more subjective measurements capitalised into the balance sheet. Also, that third issue we've got around IFRS 3, where we're capitalising acquired intangibles, and companies that are growing by acquisitions are very different from those that are growing organically. So I want to bounce my question back to Andrew, I suppose. Was there anything else coming out of the feedback that you did receive, which was quite extensive, that gives us any clues on how to think about the balance sheet going forward?
I don't think it was something that people largely focused on in their responses, to be honest. As you say, there is hostility towards simply putting in subjective values, but I think Hans probably hit the nail on the head earlier when he said that most investors don't really look at the balance sheet very much. They're more interested in capitalising cash flow.
So my question's to Nick then. Does that mean that, you know, the idea of the ratios, you know, being concerned about what's in the balance sheet, because those balance sheet numbers flow into ratios, into all sorts of performance ratios that do get used and do get extracted. Well, I'm assuming they get used. Is that not right? Am I wrong thinking?
But no, so people do look at, I guess, return on invested capital as a ratio, but often those will be adjusted ratios.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I used to keep a running total myself of, you know, goodwill that had been written off, because to me that had been spent.
Most companies use ROTE already, which is return of tangible.
Right.
Equity.
That's and certainly the credit rating agencies will focus on tangible equity and banking regulators as well, but not always. But I don't think there's a kind of one standard approach. People and companies will derive their own approaches, and if it's come from a company, it's about then interrogating that approach, making sure you're happy with how the numbers have been kept.
What I'm hearing today is I'm hearing balance sheet, okay, over here, not useful. Income statement, useful. Narrative, useful. That's what I'm hearing. Yeah. And way forward is doing more with narrative, you know, especially to Linda's points. And then here, is there more we can do within income statement and balance sheet? Well, it's just over there.
No, everything is important, but to its own place.
And we have to find a way to get rid in a better way of the largest unexplained intangible on the balance sheet.
We should be careful.
I suspect if you told investors are not getting a balance sheet, you'd find out they're important.
We should be careful not to dismiss the balance sheet. I mean, the three statements are interrelated, and people are looking at those interrelationships to understand the movements.
Exactly.
And
I suspect if you took it away, you'd hear some complaining.
Yeah.
I think that view that the balance sheet is not important, but the P&L is important is very confusing for me to understand. Right. Because the way that you define your assets, you define your income. So you capitalize certain expenses, your net income is going to change. Mm. And recurring net income is going to change. So that's now I'm going to capitalize training of my well-qualified workforce, my net income changes. So it's complicated. Even if they're not paying attention to the balance sheet, that has an effect on the recurring net income. So
presumably they need to understand what is there, to Raymond's point, like what's behind the numbers that are capitalized and what's missing. So probably think about the balance sheet in the context of the other information.
So they're not generally outside of financial stocks. People aren't looking at book values in a completely unadjusted, just take the book value number as given, and that is a measure of valuation.
And it's interesting that in the one sector where the balance sheet really matters, the banking sector, that the market value is below the book value.
That's
the future earnings are extremely depressed.
Well, in the balance sheet, what is very interesting is
in Brazil.
What is very interesting is the almost cash part. I mean, everything which is financial, I mean, if you want to know your working capital and things like that, this is very interesting. Yeah. Your cash position, your indebtedness.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, the ratio versus equity has always been a problem for me because I think that it's not meaningful. But
I don't think anyone looks at that anymore. Really, the gearing number. Yeah.
Tadeu?
Thanks, Han. Thank you for the paper. Very interesting one. I like it, and I think it's definitely part of the modern accounting. Can't avoid this subject. What I would like to draw attention is, I noticed not only in this paper, but in other papers as well, that every time that we deal with a situation where you have uncertainty and high degree of judgment, respondents used to suggest that this information should come to the financial statements and, of course, be under the auditor's report. What I would like to say that although I agree that bringing the information into the financial statements will add some reliability to the information, it will not reduce the degree of the uncertainty and judgment. And that's something that's important the market understand. I mean, that we can't sort one issue creating another problem. But I like the idea of, for example, and I believe that the information should be in the management commentary, definitely. For example, to have a separate report, a voluntary or not, depends on the territory, to provide some certain degree of assurance to the information. And finally, look at the common problem, historical problem of hockey stick projections. What I would trust more is historical metrics combined with forward-looking information and allowing the user to understand the weight of each, and then they can understand how it is influencing the information provided. Because again, I think that it's important to have forward-looking information, but when almost 95% of the information is based on forward-looking and not based on historic information, it makes the information less or increases the degree of uncertainty.
Thank you. Okay. Any more comments? No? All right. Well, thank you very much, Andrew, for this stimulating discussion.